Genesis chapter 13. So Abram went up from Egypt, he and his wife and all that he had, and Lot with him, into the Negev. Now Abram was very rich in livestock and silver and in gold. And he journeyed on from the Negev as far as Bethel to the place where his tent had been at the beginning, between Bethel and Ai, to the place where he had made an altar at the first. And there Abram called upon the name of the Lord. And Lot, who went with Abram, also had flocks and herds and tents, so that the land could not support both of them dwelling there, for their possessions were so great that they could not dwell together. And there was strife between the herdsmen of Abram's livestock and the herdsmen of Lot's livestock. At that time, the Canaanites and the Perizzites were dwelling in the land. Then Abram said to Lot, "Let there be no strife between you and me, and between your herdsmen and my herdsmen, for we are kinsmen. Is not the whole land before you? Separate yourself from me. If you take the left hand, then I will go to the right, or if you take the right hand, then I will go to the left." And Lot lifted up his eyes and saw that the Jordan Valley was well watered everywhere, like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt in the direction of Zoar. This was before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. So Lot chose for himself all the Jordan Valley, and Lot journeyed east. Thus they separated from each other. Abram settled in the land of Canaan, while Lot settled among the cities of the valley and moved his tent as far as Sodom. Now the men of Sodom were wicked, great sinners against the Lord. The Lord said to Abram after Lot had separated from him, "Lift up your eyes and look from the place where you are, northward and southward, eastward and westward, for all the land that you see I will give to you and to your offspring forever. I will make your offspring as the dust of the earth, so that if one can count the dust of the earth, your offspring also can be counted. Arise, walk through the length and the breadth of the land, for I will give it to you." So Abram moved his tent and came and settled by the oaks of Mamre, which are at Hebron. And there he built an altar to the Lord. The grass withers and the flower fades, but the word of our God stands forever.
Amen. Well, the Old Testament was written in the Hebrew language, and when you read in the Old Testament and when you see something repeated in Hebrew, you better take note because it's important. Much like we might italicize something or underline something to get your attention with a certain exclamation point, they would repeat things so that when we read, we would see what's really important. And one of the things you may have noticed is there's a very important phrase repeated in this chapter, and it's this: they lifted their eyes to see something. And so this morning, we're going to talk about eyes. And we're going to talk about this theme of Lot and Abraham lifting their eyes. And so we're first of all going to take a look at Abraham lifting his eyes. And then we're going to see, secondly, Lot's eyes. And then we're going to be led to Jesus and to consider Jesus and what Jesus lifted his eyes to see. And then we're going to ask the question, what about us? What should our eyes be fixed upon? So four sets of eyes this morning: Abraham, Lot, Jesus, and us. Well, first of all, we come to Abraham this morning, and we started our study of Abraham's life last week in chapter 12. And one of the things that we've seen coming to this point with Abraham is Abraham was called by God out of the safe and comfortable city of Ur, where he had a very good life, where he worshipped other gods. And God called him to leave to a land where God would bless him so that he might be a blessing and God would use him for his great purposes, for his kingdom. Abraham didn't know where he was going or how long it would take to get there or what it would look like. But by faith, he obeyed and he went to the land. And Abram was young in his faith. And when there was a famine and a drought in the land and there wasn't food or much to drink, Abraham, without seeking the Lord, decided that it would be best to leave the land God had called him to, and he went to Egypt. And on their way into Egypt, walking alongside his wife, Abram said, "Honey, you're beautiful. But other people are going to realize that you're beautiful. And Pharaoh might see that you're beautiful, and we might have trouble if they realize that you're my wife. So just tell people that you're my sister, and that way we won't have much trouble here in Egypt. And that's exactly what happened. And she ended up being given over to Pharaoh for quite some time, until the time came for them to leave. And that's where we come here to chapter 13. In these opening verses, we see they were leaving Egypt back to the land. Did you notice verse 1? It's very short and very subdued. We're not given very many details of their trip back to the land, but I bet it was a long drive home. What do you say to your spouse after an episode like that? How do you look at her? What do you talk about? Sarah, I'm sorry that I said you were my sister. What do you say? But here they are going back to the land with probably a rocky marriage. But they're going back to the place God had called them. And if you trace Abraham's steps here in the details that were given, we notice that Abraham is retracing his steps to the very first place where he encountered the Lord in worship. He's going back to that place where he first built an altar and worshiped the Lord. He's going back to worship after being away for quite some time. We see nothing of his time in Egypt where he worshiped the Lord or sought the Lord. But he's going back. He's doing the things that he did at first. I love in Revelation where Jesus, speaking to the churches, he says to them, "You've done many good things. I know your deeds and your hard work and your perseverance, but I hold this against you. You've forsaken your first love. Repent and do the things you did at first." I often use that in marriage counseling where couples will come and we'll talk about their marriage and it seemed to fade into a distance, or there's trouble in the marriage. And one of the questions I'll pose is, what are some of the things you did at first when you so enjoyed each other? Well, we held hands, or we talked. We spent time together. We looked in each other's eyes. We'd go out on a date. Very simple things. And I'll often say, just do what you did at first. And in a sense, that's what Abram is doing here. He's doing what he did at first. He's going back to the Lord. And we don't know how God was stirring in his heart. I would have loved to have been in this little worship service with Abram at the altar to hear his prayers and what he would have said after leaving Ur and heading to the land and then into Egypt and now back. But we see that there's something very different about the Abram that comes out of this worship service. There's something that God reminded him of. It seems as though God renewed his heart and reassured him of the promise that he had given him. There's a depth, there's a foundation, there's a courage that we see with Abram coming out of this. Because as soon as he comes out of worship, he runs into another terrible case of the Mondays. And I don't know if you've ever left a great Sunday worship service and you're so encouraged, and then you hit Monday. And then there's more complex troubles. And that's exactly what happens to Abram here. It's not with his wife, but it's with his nephew. And there's another complex, disturbing conundrum in his family life. You see, one of the things that took place in Egypt is they acquired great wealth. They became rich. And when you grew rich in their day, your 401k didn't grow. That didn't come around until a couple of years after Abram. But your cattle grew. And your herds grew. And that was what took place with Abram and Lot. Their herds grew. Now they had all kinds of sheep and cattle. And there wasn't enough room for all of their wealth. And there was strife, we're told. Not only between Abram and Lot, but between their herdsmen who were overseeing the flocks of their wealth. And we see the incredible actions of Abraham, and a radical kindness and generosity and grace and faith, because he looks at Lot and he gives Lot the option to choose. If he looks left, Lot, if you look left, you can take that land. If you look right, you can have that land and I'll go the other way. Lot, I put the ball in your court. Choose which part of the land you would like. Now this is incredible, because this is the land that God had promised to Abram. But we're told Abram, in order to avoid this strife, acted so wisely. You see, he did it so perfectly because he gave the freedom to Lot, so there would be no bitterness or Lot accusing Abram of trying to micromanage or control this. He gave the choice to Lot. But that wasn't his only option. You see, if Abram were doing the normal thing according to the custom of his day, as the elder who had some sense of respect and who wanted some shred of dignity, he had just left Egypt looking a bit like a wimp and a coward by the way he treated his wife, and now he comes back, and if he were concerned with his social standing, the last thing he would have done is say, "Lot, if you look left, you can have that land. If you look right, you can have that land." Instead, he would have said, "Young man, the land is mine." And he would have looked at his little nephew and told him to leave. He had the right to do that. Or perhaps if Abram were looking for a more comfortable life, this would have been the perfect moment to think back to the life that he once had in Ur, where it was very comfortable and secure, as we saw last week. And this would have been the perfect time to say, "I am done. This is enough. I'm tired of this craziness." And he could have turned back to the city that he came from. But what is it that motivated Abram toward this incredible act of faith and freedom to be able to offer up this incredible possession that had been promised to him by the Lord, to give this option to Lot? What was it that could have motivated Abram to do this? Well, the answer is, it's all in his eyes. You see, in the New Testament, in the book of Hebrews, they're actually very concerned with the motivation behind men like Abraham. And in chapter 11, they talk about it. And in Hebrews chapter 11, we're told what motivated Abram is that he looked forward to the city that God had promised, a city that has foundations, whose architect and builder is God. You see, Abram was so convinced of the promise of God, he knew there was nothing that could happen that would take away the promise of the Lord from him. And he had his eyes fixed on the promise of God, that God had promised this land to be the starting place where God would multiply Abram into a great nation to spread to the ends of the earth, so that through his offspring the ends of the earth might be blessed. He had his eyes fixed on that promise. That's where he was looking. That's where his eyes were. But what about Lot? What about Lot's eyes? Where were his eyes? Well, we read in verse 10 that Lot lifted his eyes. And when Lot lifted his eyes, he looked out and saw the Jordan Valley, and it was well watered. It was beautiful, like the garden of the Lord. Literally, it was greener grass. And that's what Lot chose. "I want the green grass." It reminds me of just a few nights ago, late one night, reading in bed, and it was quiet, and out of nowhere, I hear the voice of my wife from Hot Springs, Arkansas. "Why is it so cold? Why?" Well, she said, "Why?" And so I went on to explain why. I said, "Well, you know, before we moved in, they put on this extra room in the back, and it's on a slab, and I've looked in the walls, and the insulation's not that great, and I've looked at it, and so we need to get a quote on insulation." And I went on to give all these reasons why, and she said, "Ryan, I don't want to know why it's cold. I don't care why it's cold. I just don't want it to be cold. And I want you to understand how cold I am." She said, "I want to see the sunshine. I want to see the green grass." We want the green grass, don't we? And Lot, he wanted the green grass. He had other options. When Abraham came to Lot and said, "Lot, if you look left, you can go left. If you go right, you can go right, in order to save this relationship between our family." You see, Lot, he could have said, "Are you kidding me? Abraham, the promise was given to you. This is the land. I'm with you. I'm not leaving your side. I want a part of the blessing. Whatever it takes, whatever we have to face, I am in. We'll go work this out with our herdsmen. We'll work out all this bickering and strife. But I'm not leaving." Instead, Lot counted the cost. And as he thought more about this promise that was given to Abram, that God would make a great nation, I think Lot couldn't get out of his mind, "Abram, are you crazy? Your wife is barren. She can't have children. And here you're running around the whole land like a crazy man because of this promise. I'm done. This is crazy. I don't want any more droughts. I don't want any more of Abram's ideas. The land over there looks beautiful. The grass is green. It looks like the garden of the Lord. It's interesting. It's interesting as we see the author describe that Lot saw the garden of the Lord and it was pleasing to the eye. You see, because we're drawn back to chapter 3 in Genesis where there was the garden of the Lord, the very garden that we were made for, that our hearts long for, where God is central in that garden and is to be fellowshipped with. And there was a woman named Eve in the garden of the Lord, and she was deceived and saw something with her eyes that was pleasing to her eye. And it ended disastrously. And as we see in the coming chapters, Lot heading down to the Jordan Valley, it was disastrous for him. And the reason why is because what he really wanted, he wanted the garden of the Lord without the Lord. He wanted the garden, he wanted the green grass, but he didn't want his life to be built around this promise that God had given and to walk by faith along with his uncle Abram. And I think we can relate. I know I can relate. We don't like the process. We don't like the tension sometimes of living a life and not having everything that has been promised right now. Sometimes we wonder if God's in control and if He's good, why don't we have all that right now? And there's a tension and there's a suffering and there's trials. And we don't like that. And what we really want, if you want to know what I want my problems to be fixed right now. I want God to come immediately and resolve the tension in my life. I want to know what tomorrow holds. I don't want any unknowns hanging over my head. And that was the life Lot was living, a world of unknowns. What's ahead of us? Can you relate? And I don't know if this is good news or bad news, but I'll break the news to you that God's ultimate goal in your life is not to enter into your life in order to fix all of your problems right now so that there's no tension. In fact, one of the places God often has us live is in tension. In this world of the unknown, not knowing what tomorrow holds. Facing real sufferings because it's there that we live with an utter dependence upon Him. And that was the life He had Abram and Lot living, a life of utter dependence upon Him by faith. And that's the life He has called us to. And Lot decided that he didn't want to live the life of faith, but he wanted the green grass right now, what he could see, what he could touch, what he could measure. And we're told he departed. And in the very next verse, after Lot departed, here we see this theme again. Abram, lift your eyes. Lift your eyes and look northward, look southward, look eastward, and look westward. Look in every direction, and you'll see the land that I will give to you and to your offspring. Do you see, God once again comes to Abram, and He reassures him that God will keep His promises, that the promise God has made is the real deal, and that this is the starting point through which God will bless the ends of the earth through Abram and his offspring. In fact, one of the things we note as you read the rest of Abraham's life is he was never the one to actually receive these promises in his lifetime. He never saw the possession of the land. So we ask the question, did God not keep His promises? And one of the things that Paul in the New Testament, as he writes to the church in Galatia, goes out of his way to note is that, in quoting Genesis 13, by the way, Paul says, God gave the promise to Abram and to his offspring, not to his offsprings, not to multiple parties, but to one. It's the great son of Abraham, and his name is Jesus. He is the offspring who will come from Abram and who will bless the world. Jesus is the blessing that was promised to Abram. He is the one who fulfilled these promises. And like every person we read about in the Bible and in the Old Testament, as we turn to every page of the Old Testament, it takes us from a beeline, from that person to Jesus Christ. And that's what happens here. We can't read about Abraham without looking to Jesus. And that's why we're going to take a moment now to look at Jesus, who is the fulfillment of this promise that was given to Abram. And to stay with this theme of looking at the eyes of Abram and of Lot, we're going to take a look and to see what we can learn about Jesus as we see what his eyes were turned toward. And early in Jesus' ministry, it's interesting because Jesus found himself on a mountain like Abram and like Lot were. And the evil one came to tempt Jesus on the top of this mountain. And Jesus was asked to lift his eyes. And when he lifted his eyes to see the kingdoms of the world, and Satan said, "I'll give you all the kingdoms of this world if you'll bow down before me." Now, we might read that and say, well, that was easy. That's Jesus. How could he be tempted by something like that? But we have to remember, Jesus wasn't a robot. He was fully human, tempted in every way, the scriptures say. Tempted in ways that we can't comprehend. And yet he resisted. But here is probably one of the most grueling temptations, because the chain that was hanging from Jesus' neck from the time he was born was the chain of his going to the cross. And he knew that was his destiny. And here was a chance, perhaps, to get back the kingdoms of this world in some deal that would be struck with Satan so that he wouldn't have to go to the cross. But Luke tells us that Jesus resisted this temptation, and he set his face like flint toward Jerusalem. That is, he turned his eyes toward the cross. And Jesus became obedient even unto death. And he went to the cross, where he who was rich became poor, so that we who were poor might become rich. You see, Abram surrendered his rights of the land and offered them to Lot in order to enrich him. But that was nothing compared to Jesus, who laid aside the rights of heaven, who came to make us rich by going to the cross. And we're told that when Jesus was raised from the dead, 3 days later, he announced that all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to him. And do you see the good news? Do you see what took place with Jesus at the cross and the life that he lived and his being raised from the dead? This is the fulfillment of Genesis 13. This is the fulfillment of the promise to Abram. To the ends of the earth, Abram, you'll be a blessing through your offspring. And that offspring is Jesus. And now all authority in heaven and on earth is given to him. And he calls his disciples to himself and says, now go to the ends of the earth. Go to every nation and announce what I've done. And everyone who believes will be blessed. They'll receive all the blessings that were given to Abraham, for I have fulfilled them. And we're told that there were people that came to the mountain, many of his disciples. And when Jesus announced that all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to him, we're told some laid eyes on him. Some looked at him. And they believed and they worshipped him. But others, when they laid eyes upon him, they doubted. And it's so interesting to look at this. It's quite a scene, isn't it? As we consider Abram and Lot on the mountain, and they lift their eyes to survey all that's before them. And the question that comes to their mind is this the real deal? Is this really worth it, this promise that God has given to build our life around this, to put all of our chips in? And here with Jesus, we see that promise wasn't just a theoretical promise, but it was a person. It was Jesus who is now enfleshed, embodied. and those that gather around him on the mountain, as they lift their eyes, they ask that same question. Is it worth it? Is this the real deal? Is this worth putting all of our chips in? Because we know if we believe this promise, if we believe this person, he becomes the center of our life. He is our life. Yes, the promises, we see the promises, but can we really believe that God will deliver on these great promises he's made? And we come to those moments, don't we, when we're on the mountain and we're faced with those same questions. Is it worth it? Sometimes in very small things, like a gym membership. Is it worth it? Boy, we haven't been in a while. Gaining a little weight. It's $50 a month. Should we keep our gym membership? Our car's breaking down. Should we pay for the repairs or should we get a new car? So we're always faced with decisions of what's worth it. But there are some that are larger. Perhaps in your marriage, you begin to struggle. And you think of your vows. And you ask the question, is it worth it? Is it worth it? And then there's some times that we lift our eyes to consider questions of whether or not it's worth it that are so monumental. It's like standing on the mountains on the continental divide. And this is the case when it comes to Jesus Christ and our relationship with him. Perhaps you're here and you're not a Christian, but you're wondering, you're exploring, you're taking a look at what Jesus has said and what he's claimed. And you realize that to turn to Christ means being crucified with him, and he is your life. And you wonder, is it worth it? Some of you who are Christians and facing real struggles, you're asking that question. And it's like the continental divide where you stand on the mountain. And it's amazing if you place your hands out and if a snowflake falls into this hand and melts and the water falls, somehow it ends up in the Pacific Ocean. And if it lands in this hand and melts, it can somehow end up in the Gulf or in the Atlantic. And Christ is like that. And some look at Christ and ask the question, is it really worth it? Is this the real deal? And decide that the grass of this world is greener and it's simply not worth it to take Jesus and his claims seriously. It'll hamper our life. And yet others, with eyes of faith, are willing to say, I'm ready to face hell on earth with joy to suffer for Christ, for he is my life. What in the world is the difference in motivation? What would bring some people to say, on the one hand, I want nothing to do with Jesus, or at least I'll keep him in the back seat, and others to say, he is my life, he's my everything. You see, it's all in the eyes. You see, by eyes of faith, Abram saw the promise and believed God was trustworthy. And this is the question we're asking, isn't it? How do we do this? What would motivate people to do this? And this is what we're asking about ourselves and our own eyes. What about us? Where should our eyes be fixed? What should we lift our eyes to see as Abram and Lot and even Jesus lifted their eyes? Well, this is the question we turn to. What about us? And this is one of the major questions that Paul, in writing to the church in Galatia — I believe there's a small group, by the way, studying the book of Galatians, so you can remember this — but Paul, in writing to the book of Galatians, one of the major questions he's asking is that question. Where are your eyes turned to, church? Where have you turned your eyes? He talks about their eyes, actually. He says, before your very eyes, Jesus Christ was clearly portrayed as crucified. How have you so quickly deserted this gospel? Now, the facts of the matter are they didn't really see Jesus crucified. But what Paul's saying is when he arrived there, he announced the gospel so clearly and spoke it to them and taught them so clearly what Christ had done to them and who Christ is. It was as if they saw him publicly portrayed as crucified. And now Paul says someone has bewitched you. And that's a word for like witchcraft, which glazes over your eyes and you're in sort of a trance. And Paul looks at this church and says, someone has bewitched you. Your eyes are glazed over. You're no longer looking to Christ as your everything. And there were people that had infiltrated this church. There were people that had infiltrated this church with new teachings. And these people that came in, they knew what the Galatian church was struggling with. They knew that they were under great persecution for their commitment to Christ. They knew that there was tension in this church and living this life of persecution. They knew that there was a desire to be free from guilt and free from their former lives and to have freedom and to have peace and to have joy. And Paul talks about all these things in his letter. And these people came and said, "We have a great option for you. You see, we have a better religion. We love Jesus. Jesus is great, but He's not everything. You had a great start with the gospel, but now you need to move on to some more hands-on religion so that you can relieve this tension in your life and you can know for sure, because of what we can offer you, what you can do, that you can be right with God, that you can have that freedom. And by the way, to throw this in, the grass is a lot greener because you won't be persecuted. We're in really good with the Jews. We're in really good with the townspeople. And if you come join us, it'll be so much better for your family life. The grass will be greener." And the Galatians seem to be captivated. Their eyes seem to be captivated by this. And so Paul asks, "Where are your eyes? How have you turned so quickly from this? How do you deal with this? What do you say to a church like this?" Well, Paul's answer is Galatians 13. Paul talks extensively about Abraham to the Galatians. And what he explains to them is that all the blessings they so desire, the kingdom that they desire to be their destiny, to be right with God, to be justified, to be free, all these things that this other group is offering to them, all of these blessings of Abraham are found in Jesus Christ. And if you turn to anything else, if you only partially have Jesus, then you don't have any of it. You want to be justified. You want to be right with God. You want to be free. You want to have joy. You want to have peace. You have none of this so long as your eyes are turned in this other direction. And Paul's saying, turn your eyes back. Turn your eyes back to Him who was crucified for you and raised from the dead and who showed you that God's promise is the real deal. In Him, you're justified. In Him, He is your righteousness. He is the one who sets you free. He is the green grass. But it's by faith. And so Paul says, I've been crucified with Christ. And it's no longer I who live, but it's Christ who lives in me. The life I live in the body, he says to this church. I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave Himself for me. You want freedom? Paul says. You want to be free? It is for freedom that Christ has set us free. This is the great blessing of the promise to Abraham. It's for freedom that Christ has set us free. Stand firm then, he says. And do not let yourselves be burdened again by a yoke of slavery. Are you burdened this morning with a yoke of slavery? With the yoke of the slavery of guilt or despair? Or feeling as though you're not worthy of God's kingdom. And you're trying and you're exhausting yourself to somehow get into that kingdom or to be right with God or to wake up in the morning and to feel His love. Paul says you have it in Jesus Christ. In Him you have all the blessings of Abraham. The curse has been satisfied in Jesus Christ. For everyone who has ever struggled with unbelief or doubts or has lacked faith, Jesus died for them so that in Him they're free. You're free. Jesus is the green grass. And I love the honesty. I love the honesty of the Bible as we read about churches like Galatia where they certainly didn't have it all together and they had real struggles. And I love the honesty of the stories of Abraham and Lot. And they're like us, aren't they? Where they have real struggles. And sometimes there's days that are good. And sometimes there's days that are bad. And they struggle with sin. And they have a tough family life. And there's conflict. And there's strife. They struggle with unbelief and with doubt. Sometimes they are very spiritually dry and distant. There's tension in their life. They don't know what tomorrow holds. All these things. And yet, as we see with Abraham, He drags himself back into worship. just like us, week after week, after these weeks of our circumstances being up and down and struggling with so many things and the temptation that comes, we pull ourselves back into worship. And it's our hope that God will do in our hearts what He did in Abram's heart, where He reminded Abram of all that's true. And He reassured Abram that His promise is the real deal and that He is a God who keeps His promises. In fact, this is a great description of the Christian life. The Christian life is a constant turning of our eyes back to Jesus Christ and to the promise that we have in Him. For Jesus Himself said, "Everyone who looks to the Son will live." But we forget that. And our life is one of just constantly turning our eyes back to Him. When we come here and when we gather together in worship, we're turning our eyes back to Christ. We're turning our eyes back to the promise to remember what's true, to be renewed in our confidence and our faith, strengthened to know that God is a God who keeps His promises. It reminds me of another man who lifted his eyes to see something in Revelation chapter 5. We're told John saw a scroll. It was a book. And in this book, it contained the history and the present of the church and her sufferings and all God's dealings with His people. But the book was sealed. And until the book was opened, until this scroll was opened, the great promises that God has made, even the promises to Abram, that He were fulfilled in Jesus Christ, these promises would not be enacted. They wouldn't be complete. They wouldn't be final until this scroll was opened. And we're told John looked across the world, the earth, to find someone worthy to open this scroll. And he couldn't find anyone. And we're told that he wept. And he wept because no one was worthy to open the scroll. And then he heard these words. "Look. Lift your eyes," you might say. And we're told John looked and he saw one who looked as though he were a lamb who had been slain sitting on the throne. And it was Jesus who had redeemed people from every nation, tongue, and tribe around the world. And He is worthy to open the scroll. And when He opened the scroll, we're told that thousands upon thousands of angels, together with God's people on the earth, erupted with joy to praise Him who is worthy. All glory and riches and honor and power are Yours, O God. You see, because these are the people that have waited so long by faith. We've journeyed so long by faith and not by sight, trusting that the promise of God is sure. And looking to Jesus, they see the One who will bring these promises about, and they rejoice in His presence with great joy. And isn't that what happens when we come back and we lay our eyes upon Jesus, and we see the One who came and who was crucified to fulfill these promises for you, for me? You know, when we started this church just about a year ago, there was a gentleman who started visiting the church, and he has since left because he moved to another city to take care of his aging mother. But he would come and he'd sit in the back. This was when we had less people and you could sort of see people out there. And he didn't sing and he didn't come forward for communion, and because he didn't believe this stuff. But he was so curious. And so we began talking, and one of the things he shared with me is that he had experienced a terrible tragedy and lost his wife and was living in a sleepy suburb further away and was ready to live life. And he was looking for a place where he could come, where there would be life. And he saw Royal Oak, a place where there was a lot of life and there was a nightlife and there was a lot of people he could meet, and he could get a condo and come live and have the greener grass. And the question I asked him is this: did it work? He said, "No, it's not working. It's not what I thought. It's not the green grass that I was hoping for." Then several months later, I saw him come forward for communion. And we got together that next week. And we began talking about these things. And I asked him, what's going on? And he said, for the first time I sat in a service. And I've always listened to those words and wondered what they mean. For the first time I sang. For the first time I sang those words. And I came forward because now I believe. Now I see what you mean. Where there's life. You see, he used to have the eyes of Lot, who on the surface saw the green grass. And it looked so good that the thought of living by faith and turning to the promise of God seemed like it would ruin his life. And now he has the eyes of faith, turning to Christ and finding that life. What about you? As you lift your eyes, as we lift our eyes and survey all that's around us, all the green grass or the white snow that's around us, and all the opportunities you have to really live, what is it that will do it for you? What do your eyes see? What's the garden of the Lord for you? Is it a person? Is it money? What's the hope for our city? Is it more money or a better government? What is it that will really solve the problems in your life and relieve the tension that will bring you to that place that's so beautiful, like the garden of the Lord, that will satisfy? You see, if our eyes are fixed on these things, the joy we search for will elude us, just like it eluded Lot. It'll be disastrous. Just like my friend who had visited here had experienced in his own life. Until by faith we lift our eyes with eyes of faith and see the Lamb who's on his throne, Abraham's great son, who secured the city for us and has said it is now our inheritance. This is what we're to fix our eyes upon. And as Jesus himself said, when you look to the Son, you will have life. And so as we think about our eyes and what our eyes are fixed upon, may we be reminded and assured that the promise of God is true, and that promise and all the promises to Abraham are fulfilled in Jesus Christ. And he is your life. He is your hope and your righteousness and the inheritance and the land and the city that he has secured, the city that has foundations, he secured for you. And like Abram, you can look ahead to that city with foundations, knowing that it's yours.